This is Countryfile Live 2019, the podcast that lets you relive some of the best moments from the talks and presentations that happened in the National Trust Theatre at this year's BBC Countryfile Live event at Blenheim Palace. In this series, you'll hear from the likes of Ray Mears on the best time to get involved with nature, from J.B. Gill on his transition from fame to farming, and from Timothy Bentinck, a.k.a. David Archer, who gives us a peek behind the scenes of the Archers. In this extract from the National Trust Theatre at BBC Countryfile Live 2019, we join Countryfile presenter Charlotte Smith in conversation with wildlife cameraman Simon King. He discusses wildlife photography, how to make lions yawn, and how tourism benefits the natural world.
If I am brutally honest, I'm 57 years old. I started making wildlife films when I was 10, so I've been in the business for 47 years, and I actually started wielding a camera professionally when I was 17. So as a wildlife camera person, I've been doing that for a little while. And though I don't do as much of that now as I once did, I certainly still do. And if I am really brutally honest, I have spent most of my professional life being paid to do absolutely nothing. And that's true, because almost all of what I do is wait. I wait for something to happen. Now, it does mean I can't just nod off. I'm not saying it's never happened. There have been moments when I have nodded off, certainly. In fact, I'll tell you a story. You're going to get used to me if you haven't heard me speaking before. I just go off on tangents. There was a moment when I was filming herring gulls on the island of Steepholm. And I had been, I know it sounds really mundane, but I had been in a hide day after day after day waiting for a chick to hatch in a nest. So I was not able to sleep. The hide was perched on the edge of a cliff. And I made sure that my seat wasn't too comfortable, precisely so that I didn't fall asleep. Only there was a moment when I woke up with my head out of the hide, looking down the cliff, having fallen off my chair, having fallen asleep, which taught me a salutary lesson, which was to get a more comfy chair. No. I spent thousands of hours. And of course, some of the creatures that I do spend a lot of time with are the great predators. One of the reasons I get employed as a wildlife camera person is to point long lumps of glass, telephoto lenses, at things like that to try and reveal them at their best, i.e. at the most dynamic. And of course, the predators are phenomenally dynamic, hence part of the reference to killing time. Because as well as me spending a tremendous amount of time waiting for them to get up, that's what we're waiting for them to do. Watching lions, as I have for a large lump of my life, one realizes that they are very good at sleeping. The old adage that lions can spend 23 out of 24 hours sleeping, I'm not sure that's strictly true. I think, I'm not going to be flippant and say it's 23 and a half. But to be really honest, when we're looking at lions, as we are most of the time, from dawn to dusk, you spend about a 14, 15 hour day. You get out before light, you get out after dark. In the middle, there's a 12 hour day on the equator. So you've got 12 hours in which these creatures have got to get up and do something funky. It's a little bit like going into every human bedroom from about 11 o'clock at night to 6 o'clock in the morning and expecting something cool to happen. Now, don't be vulgar. I know from time to time something might happen. And that's the point, really, is that, yes, of course it happens, but it's not their time. When they kick off is when it's cool and dark and they're out and doing their thing. So we're really just eavesdropping on these moments when these guys are just going, oh, for heaven's sake, leave us alone. Beautiful though it is, it does mean that there's a great deal of that. Oh, by the way, yawning. Little tangent, another one. Is anyone yawning yet? Because they're looking, yeah, I saw one brewing there. You start looking at lions yawning and you're going, True story, lions will yawn if you yawn at them. And I've tried it. If they're close enough and you happen to catch, most of the time lions don't really look at you. Leopards do. Leopards, if you're in the car, leopards go like that. Lions kind of go, actually, they don't pant them like this. They're kind of, but every now and again, you'll fix eyes with a lion. Donk. And when you do, go, like you all do, just go. And honestly, even in a zoo, they'll go. And that's because yawning in social creatures is a trigger. It's the same with us and any other social creature. With dogs, it works. With social cats. Doesn't work with cheetahs because they're far less social. But with lions, they've got to get up together and they go to sleep together. So by having the yawn as a trigger that echoes through the group, they either all kip together or they all get up and go together. And when they do get up and go, it's dramatic stuff. Cheetahs, different story. Cheetahs are, by and large, diurnal, especially the females with cubs. They try to be active by day. Why? Because they are potentially prey, or at least they're going to be subjugated by every other larger predator on the plains, whether it's a hyena, whether it's a lion, wild dog, or painted dogs, as I like to describe them now. And especially, as I say, lions can not only chase cheetahs, but kill them. So they do their very best to get out of the way of when all of those other predators are super busy during the hours of darkness, not including the wild dogs or the painted dogs. And they are busy during daylight hours, which is why we get to see cheetahs doing what they do at high speed in broad daylight from time to time on wildlife films. And I've had the great good fortune to spend years, thousands and thousands of hours working with cheetahs in the wild and to record them doing what we might expect, chasing fleet-footed antelope at enormous speeds and bringing them down. And it's one of the most astonishing events to witness in the natural world. There's no doubt about it.
Who would like to ask Simon a question? Starting over here, sir.
Hello, my name's Tony. The question was, when you filmed the hunters and then David obviously presented the television programme, how much interaction has there got to be between the two of you, if there is any or isn't there any?
Between David and myself?
Yes.
I'm a weird beast in this industry because very often as a cameraman, one of the things I do is I help with storyboards, so I draw things, and I very often, because I like doing it, I'll scribble ideas down and thoughts in a narrative. Now, that's not to say that that's definitely what David will do. As it happens, David was in Botswana at the same time as me, just at the beginning of this shoot, because he was presenting in Vision Life of Mammals, and it was his, he authored the series, and He was present whilst we were talking about elephants. So we had ample opportunity to talk over a glass of tonic water to talk about principles and the broad narrative. But anything you ever see on television is the end result of a collaboration of a lot of people. You know, I'm just one of many, many people working in a system from the very beginnings, the concept, from the people who actually got to do the hard stuff, which is find the money to make it in the first place, all the way through to the production editors and so on and so on and so on. But the drawings, some of which I've made, are not unlike the sequence.
I just wondered if he had to have the feel from you. That's all.
I think David got the feel. I think, honestly, he's a wonderful human being and very sensitive to what that meant. No one can perhaps experience it if you haven't lived it, and I lived it, and I'm enormously grateful for that.
Hi, my name is Jackie. Can I just be a bit provocative? The talk that you've given is amazing, and I couldn't agree more with your sentiments. How do you then relate that back to, you were talking about trips and tours that you run in Africa, which must involve air trips and carbon miles? I agree that raising awareness is so important, but how do you square those two things?
I hope that those people who travel with me, I believe, because they've traveled with me more than once, quite a few of them, have an increasing sense of connection to what matters, and they change and modify the way they live. Of course, there's the vicarious pleasure in witnessing extraordinary things. I've just come back from an extraordinary trip in South Africa where we were seeing all the things. Anyone who travels to Africa, get this. Aardvark, daylight. Honey badger, daylight. Pangolin, daylight. So anyone who knows Africa knows that's a biggie. So yes, that's part of the gig, is enjoying the space. And most of the places I visit, probably all of them, in this day and age would not exist anymore were it not for the dollars, pounds, euros that come into them because of ecotourism. The Masai Mara Serengeti ecosystem, the Frankfurt Zoological Society is an exception, but the Mara, I believe, would have been wheat fields decades ago were it not for tourism. The money that comes in as a result of us coming to see a lion or to witness an event like that ensures that there is, in the curious mentality of us species, human beings, a value in that space.
My name's Alice. Have you ever got hurt whilst filming?
Have I got hurt whilst filming? Gosh, yes. Any time I've had a problem, it's always been my fault, Alice. You know, I'd never, ever, ever would I say it's the animal's fault. So what have I had? I've got a man scar. That one there.
Oh, it's huge.
Yeah.
It's about this big.
Yeah, it's tiny. That was a cheetah that had rabies.
And it's more impressive than you just said that.
And I thought it was being friendly, and it wasn't, and it attacked me. And so I had to, well, actually what I did, this is funny, Alice, because it was coming towards me and I thought it was purring, and then I realised it was growling. And at the time I was saying, hello, sweetie. I was going, hello, sweetie, hello, sweetie, oh, hello, and poof, and it jumped up and I kicked it, and then it attacked a friend of mine, so I grabbed it by the neck and it turned around and scratched and bit me. And sadly, it died about 24 hours later because it had rabies, which is a very nasty disease. And I don't have rabies because I'm still here drinking water. So, but I've been chased by rhinos. I've had snakes have a go at me. So what was the most recent one? Probably a horsefly.
Right, my name is Sarah. Is there an animal that you like photographing the most?
Oh, is it? Yes. Do I like photo? Honestly, Sarah, if I could not, this is going to sound really selfish, and it is. If I could not take a camera out, I wouldn't. And by that, I mean my joy is in the watching and the being and being present with these things. It always has been. I call myself a naturalist first and foremost, and I happen to have cameras, and I can sort of point them at things sometimes. And that's a way of earning a living. I can do it. But is there a certain pleasure from time to time in recording an event? Yeah. And if I had to only record one creature for the rest of my life from now and nothing, it would be otters, European otters. I would just be with them for now forever because they are utterly mesmerizing. They are charming. They are at ease in two elements, from the sea or the fresh water to the land is a seamless join in their lives. And yeah, it's a bit anthropomorphic, but they look like they have fun quite often. Maybe not, but I think they do. And just watching a family of otters, a mum lying down and with two big cubs rolling around and all grooming each other, it's just gorgeous. I've had so many glorious encounters. I've spent thousands and thousands of hours with them. And one of the fondest memories I have is working with a group of otters so much that they become used to me, so my scent no longer matters. They fall asleep on a rock 3 meters away. I fall asleep on a rock 3 meters away because we're on the same rhythm. They get woken up by the tide rising. I get woken up by the tide rising. They're comfortable. I'm not. That's just a lovely rhythm for me. And whether or not it involves a camera, I don't mind.
The Guardian today has published a leaked report from the IPCC stating basically that unless we all turn vegetarian now, there's not a hope for the human race.
This is actually a report which will be published next week, and because I've read a bit of it, it's a slightly more nuanced message than that. But it talks about land use.
But it's much more important and profound than that, because what we're actually talking about is the catastrophic effect on the environment of raising animals as opposed to eating the vegetables that we feed those animals. I've got graphs which I could bore you with. It takes about 30 square meters to raise a kilo of beef. It takes about 1 square meter to raise a kilo of veg. Okay, you say, well, beef is worth so much more than veg as a nutritious diet. Okay, well, let's talk about calories. It's exactly the same. Just over a square meter to raise 1,000 calories of vegetables, and it's about 35 square meters to raise 1,000 calories of beef. It's a no-brainer. Anyone who has a little garden, and I have, well, in the past I'm actually in transition, but I have grown my own veg a lot in the past, and we all know at this time of year, courgettes and beetroot, my goodness, you can get sick of them.
Oh,
but,
yes.
But it works. You can get enough nutrition out of an incredibly small patch, and it's your duty to do it. Even if you've got a window box, don't have just stuff in there that looks cute. Grow some radishes, eat stuff. It's important. And it's a really important thing for younger people to witness. Stick a seed in the ground, see it sprout, realize that's the very thing that's going to feed you. if each and every one of us were to change to a vegan diet, by that I mean the 7.5 billion people on Earth, overnight, the amount of land being used for agriculture would shrink.
We've had various people here talking about nature, talking about our relationship with nature, and I don't think we've had anybody who hasn't sounded a warning as part of their remarks.
Yeah, I mean, it is sobering wherever I go in the planet, but in the UK especially, perhaps, just what catastrophic decline there has been in our fauna. Any of us who were paying attention in 1979 when I did that diary will have had a very different experience of British wildlife from that which we could get today. And what scares me, as quite a lot of young faces I'm delighted to see in the audience today, is that the baseline that those young people have to refer to is very different from the one I referred to. Most of the kids here may not have heard a cuckoo this year. That is a tragedy. That is a tragedy. Everyone heard cuckoos. They were everywhere. They were all over the place. They've gone. They may not have heard a skylark. They may not have heard a lapwing displaying. That's a tragedy too. I mean, the fact that there are still these great spectacles like the gannets on the coast is something to be proud of, but we can't rest on laurels. We cannot just sit on our laurels and say, oh, well, there's lots of life. Let's just crack on with the way we are. You can't afford to do that. And we think back of the great extinction periods in history. I'm not going to get all too science lesson on you, I promise. There have been some big drop-offs. And the Permian extinction was a massive one. Massive. At least 60% of species, boom, disappeared. Now, there's all sorts of debate about what happened, but almost certainly it was cataclysmic effects on our atmosphere as a consequence of volcanic and or meteorite activity. In other words, massive climate change. Massive climate change at a speed which we have not witnessed on Earth since until now. And the same is happening right now. We are looking at the precipitation of the next great extinction. Only this time, it's nothing to do with a meteorite, and it's nothing to do with a volcano, and it's everything to do with us. And the irony is, we all love the natural world. We care, we're passionate, we do, and we have it in our gift to do something about the change, but we're not doing it. And we're not doing it fast enough. Because the very systems that support life on Earth, we are continuing to trash. I mean, if you look at the changes on forest cover across the planet, you might think, oh, well, it's not that different. The dark green is original forest and the light green, put them both together. And then the light green is what's left. Since the beginning of humanity started cutting trees down, 10,000 years or so roughly. So you think, oh, well, it's not so bad, is it? That's okay. It's not okay. It's really not okay, because it is that very system, that life support system that gives us the air we breathe, sucks up the carbon that we've been producing and processes it and locks it in. And we are getting rid of it. Look at those great tracts across Asia that have disappeared at the most astonishing rate. And you'd think, yeah, but that was back in the 70s and 80s, wasn't it, when we didn't know better? It's getting better now because we know better. Everyone knows better, is it? That's how it is. Look at the rate of deforestation now compared to 2001. It is greater now than ever before. With all the knowledge we have, with all the knowledge we have. Why? Lots of reasons. Agriculture, number one. Overwhelmingly, that's it. And what does that mean? What's actually being done? Trees, especially in the tropics, are being cut down largely to grow soybean, as well as some other crops. And you go, oh, it's all your vegan vegetarian trouble, isn't it? You guys who eat tofu, it's your fault. If only that were so, because the percentage of soya that's actually used in the human food chain that's grown currently is less than 6%. 70% is grown to feed beef cattle. And those forests are being cut down to feed beef stocks, to feed us. And therein lies the rub. We have to change the way we eat. And if we don't, the next great extinction will include probably our species, and certainly many species around us. And we've really, really, really got to realise that we're talking now. We're not talking 10 years, 15. We're talking now, 5 years. We should all be afraid and we should all be doing something different. And we can. That's the beautiful thing. If ever there was a brilliant argument for rewilding, and I love the phrase rewilding, if ever there was a brilliant argument for rewilding, and this is something I just grabbed off the internet from Rewilding Europe, which all looks kind of Eden and idyllic and blah, and there's a nice little farm down there, isn't there, and isn't it cute? It can work. It can work because those very, let's use a business term, ecosystem services, they are worth a fortune, an absolute fortune, because without them, there is no business. We're stuffed. There's nothing. We need it back. But if you've never met or seen a European bison or a wisent or visent as they're known, then, oh, you've got to. They're fabulous. Most people never have. Continental Europe, they should be everywhere. And they are, as the screen suggests, a keystone species because they create so many habitats. They create sandbars, which creates habitats for other creatures. Their dung is a host for dung beetles, which feeds birds, and so on and so on and so on. And that is what we need back in place. And there are examples of it right now in the UK. Anyone who's ever been to the NEPA state in West Sussex will know that it's demonstrably practical to have animals, livestock, indeed a resource. The last piece of beef I ate was one of those dudes. It was a long time ago because I haven't been to NEP for a while. But they have longhorn cattle and deer and others and Tamworth pigs, all of which are living in a feral state across the entire estate. They're not fed anything extra. There's no foodstuff goes into them. There's no drench goes on them. They are not, so their dung is, you know, one of the reasons, there's a, I don't know, any birders in the group? Anyone who would love to see a redback shrike? Yeah? Yeah, cool. They used to be all over the UK, especially southern England. Why are there no redback shrike? Redback shrike, favorite food? Dung beetles. What don't we have in cow dung anymore? Dung beetles. Why? Because we stuff chemicals down the necks of cattle, so every single, of course, parasite, but anything in that dung that is an invertebrate can't live. So there are no dung beetles. So there are no redback shrikes. We break systems all the time in the name of progress. And what we actually do is see this regression. There was a really interesting piece on Farming Today the other day. It was about bug banks and how bug banks around the edges of arable fields are so much more effective than pesticides. But it takes a 3 to 5 year period for it to establish and find equilibrium. You don't spray them, you don't kill them, you find balance, you find equilibrium, and you find a way forward.
Hello, my name's John, and I'm a videographer. How long do you spend waiting for a special shot that you're looking for? And any funny experiences whilst you're in that area?
Well, I did a presentation yesterday called Killing Time, and I started by saying I spend most of my life being paid to do absolutely nothing, which is true, because the vast majority of my time, in professional time as a camera person, is spent doing nothing, waiting for an event. And to answer your question glibly, you know, an average sequence that appears on television that might be between 3 to 5 minutes long, on average will take between 6 and 8 weeks to achieve. Sometimes significantly longer, depending on the event. And one shot that might be particularly elusive, I'll give you a great example very quick, he says. I'm never quick, am I? But I'll give you a good example of a story. Years and years and years ago, I was asked to film a sparrowhawk coming to a bird table to catch a bird. Now, you've got to wait at a bird table. And we had great research going on, and we had people telling us, oh, yes, a sparrowhawk comes every day. Yeah. So I put a hide up on the best garden. It happened to be on the edge of Dartmoor, where a sparrowhawk came every single day. And I know, even then, way back, I knew the sounds of alarm calls of birds when a sparrowhawk was in the area. So I'm sitting there. My finger has to be on the button. I know how quick these birds are. My finger's on the button. Cut a long story short, 14 hours a day, 7 days. Now, for the first 3 days, I was moderately interested in the great tits and blue tits that were visiting. On day 4, I wanted to kill them. Sparrowhawk, quick, come. Anyway, day 7, mid-morning, I heard an alarm call, pressed the button, male sparrowhawk came in, went round the bird table once, turned over backwards, grabbed a blue tit and flew off. So the actual event took about half a second. So if you work out the hours per second return on that, it gives you some idea.
Hi, I'm Lukash, and what's your favourite bird?
Oh, my favourite bird, Luke. It wavers. I'm a sucker for the raptors, for birds of prey, because they're charismatic. I can't help getting carried away by it. And when I go whoop, like I've mentioned earlier, if I see a hobby coming over, especially if it's hunting swallows or house martins, that's pretty funky. Peregrine, right up there, because, again, they're dynamic and they're powerful. You just know they're built for speed. And a peregrine that's just gracefully chopping across the sky, looking for prey, is already quick and powerful. And then when it goes into that galvanized bullet of predatory speed, it just shoots across the sky, and your imagination flies with that. Something that's gone from 50, 60 miles an hour to 150, 200, 210, 220. You don't know how fast that thing's going unless you're a pigeon, and then bang, you don't know much about that either. So yeah, peregrine.
I am Isaac Trigg, and what was your first picture of the bird what you took?
Hi, Isaac. The first picture of a bird ever that I took. Do you know, I actually know the answer to this. The first time I ever took a picture of a bird, it was of a lesser black-back gull, and it was out of my bedroom window in Bristol, and I was terribly proud of it. And I found it the other day, and it's hilarious, because not only is it very small in frame, slightly out of focus and flying away from me, but my finger is over the lens. So it was a real winner. I call it art. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been lovely. Thank you so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, Simon King.
Thanks for listening to this extract from the many talks and debates that happened in the National Trust Theatre at BBC Countryfile Live 2019. To learn more about this and other audio programmes from the National Trust, go to nationaltrust.org.uk/podcasts. And to purchase your ticket for BBC Countryfile Live 2020, go to countryfilelive.com. This is a National Trust podcast recorded at BBC Countryfile Live 2019.